2 Romeo India Whiskey. My name is Dick. At this time, we begin the check-in on Limerick. Our machine's putting out more power than I expected it to. As you guys have heard so many times, TechNet is a gathering of curious, interested radio amateurs who want to know more about radio equipment, gather and teach each other as we discover. There's thousands of things to learn about how radio, how wireless equipment really works. And the books only partially cover it. The classes that you can take on it, the courses you can take only partially cover it. We amateurs find out in our own way many of the secrets, and we share those secrets among each other. The rules of thumb that really make antennas and transmission lines and transmitters and receivers work, and satellites and repeaters, digital systems, and so on. So, something like 27 or 28 different kinds of ham radio. What you're listening to right now, 2-meter ham radio on a repeater. It's just one of the 27 kinds. This is arguably one of the most educational hobbies there is. So if for some reason you're disappointed with it, let me drop. Before you give up the hobby, try to one of the other 26 kinds to make sure that you're not missing something. TechNet is broken up into three sections. The first section, people sign in with their call letters and name because they do have a question or a comment, and we take them in order. Then that's followed by Dr. Roy, AC2GS, a practicing physician and scientist, gives us the mailbag and what he calls science.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
You're not duplex.
Yes, I'm partially duplex. I'm duplex by way of the Selden machine. When I try to run duplex on the Glen Oaks machine, sometimes my receiver becomes overloaded. But right now it's going pretty well. I've reset the squelch. And that was Joe, W-H-O-R-Y-Y. We're going to sign him in. R-Y-Y. A guy named Joe. And he almost always has an exciting question for us. Of all the subjects that ham radio operators discuss, the subject that is most troublesome in the big picture are antennas. How does an antenna work? How in the world do you feed a signal into an antenna? And somehow it gets converted to an electromagnetic wave that propagates in space. There's a lot of magic that takes place there. A lot of ways to try to explain it that only partially work. Let me drop. And in order for that antenna to work well, it must present a good resistive termination, impedance, to the transmission line that's feeding that antenna. We almost always use transmission lines. In the very early days of ham radio, a ham would operate his shack in the attic of the house, wooden house, and on a wooden table would be the transmitter. And the center of the dipole would be the transmitter itself, with one of the half of the dipole going out the eastern window and half of the dipole going from the wooden desk, the transmitter, to the western window. Well, we eventually got relegated to the basement, and we needed a transmission line between the antenna and the transmitter. So our transmission lines have got some peculiar characteristics. Properly terminated, a 50-ohm transmission line will look like 50 ohms no matter how long it is. Let me drop. But if you put anything but a pure resistive 50 ohms on the end of that transmission line, the transmission line will give you some peculiar characteristics, which change as the length of the transmission line changes. Ordinarily, properly terminated, transmission line can be any length, and it always looks the same. But any kind of an impedance mismatch at the end of the transmission line, you're going to have some amount of signal you send to it reflected back down the transmission line. And that reflected signal gets transposed into some other impedance, depending on the length of the line. If the length of the line is an odd number of quarter wavelengths, you get impedance inversion. Put a short circuit at the far end, and you'll see an open circuit at the near end. Or, conversely, put an open circuit at the far end, you'll see a short circuit at the near end, if it is an odd number of quarter wavelengths long. If it's an even number of quarter wavelengths long, then it tracks short circuit at the far end will look like a short circuit at the near end. If you're halfway between quarter wave and half wave in the length of the transmission line, and even though you've only got a resistive mismatch, you will see a reactance at the input end. You think you're seeing a capacitor or an inductor. How in the world does a transmission line do that? You'd be amazed at that story. There's some simple rules of thumb you can use, but if you go back to the real basic theory and the equations, it'll drive you up a wall. That's just a little bit about what we learned. Let me drop back. Some of the magic we try to teach each other with rules of thumb, with simple rules that gives us some of this information that you can find here on the TechNet that you might not find in a book and you might not find in a course that you're taking. Okay, now's the time for you guys to check in because you do have a question or a comment. And you need not sign in just because you're listening after something like, let me think now, 1982, 37 years. Yeah. 36 and a half years. After 36 and a half years, we believe somebody is listening. That doesn't have to be proven anymore. So, when you do have a question or a comment, please give me your call letters and name right now. K2RIW, listening.
C2KKX with a comment.
1YDY with a question.
Okay, the last guy in YDY was Hank. JKX, he's going to have to tell me his name because I'm so forgetful. And we probably have Joe. Let's see now. Joe, JKX, YDY. Anyone else to check in who does have a question or a comment? Give me your call letters and name right now.
A2SAY, Doug.
Good old W-A-2-S-A-Y, Doug. We're hearing him a little bit more late frequently. That's good. Okay. Anyone else to check in? Give me your call letters and name right now. Okay, Mr. JKX, I think he said he's got a comment. So, JKX, give me your full prefix and your name, which I should know. K2RIW listening.
That's KC2KKX, and the name is Peter. And I'd like to make a comment about a statement, which I believe was incorrect, that was made last week about X-rays and gamma rays.
Okay. We're going to go in order, and we're going to come to you real soon now, Pete. Thank you. So let's start off with Joe first, the B2RYY. Let's see if Joe's got a question. He almost always does. You got it, Joe. B2RY, the computer, check that.
I thought I saw her and somebody had to die with you. Is there somebody else out there that just transmitted what Dick transmitted?
Go right ahead with your question, Joe.
It's Roy Roy here. Okay, this goes back to one I think you've covered this subject before, but it's interesting to talk about. And that's different forms of repeater descent, being that you're talking about a repeater right now. And I think a good example of what I'm talking about would be the time you were over my QTH. And I was demonstrating something to you by putting a weak signal out into a repeater receiver located at my house. And I had an instance to move the garage door. And when I did that, you could hear that noise, you know, come back onto the repeater input receiver that I was using at the particular time. Here's the question. If you had that happen on a live site, so to speak, like what you're on right now, you're on a comm site, you got three buildings up there, all sorts of different antennas, mechanical things moving or whatever, how would you really find something like that in reality? You got some sort of noise that's being produced because it's part of your transmitted pattern. It's taking up part of the transmitted pattern of your RF energy and being reflected back to itself to really cause some havoc on your receiving system. Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, one of the phenomena you could be discussing right now, Joe, is called the rusty nail phenomenon. And people who set up repeaters, single-side repeaters, discovered this phenomenon many decades ago. If near a transmitting antenna, there is something acting like a rusty nail, in other words, a slightly erratic contact being made between a metallic surface and some other metallic surface on the tower, for instance, and the wind is blowing, or the really weird case, the most severe case that Joe ran into once is that he was testing a repeater by temporarily mounting the antenna on top of a chain link fence. And that chain link fence consists of thousands of individual joints where the pieces of wire are woven through each other to make up the chain link fence. And with the slightest motion of the fence, the wind blowing or whatever, you get scratchy contacts. And those scratchy contacts make a kind of intermodulation distortion. They will take the transmitting signal, spread it into a very weak wideband signal, and that wideband signal encompasses the receiving frequency, 600 kCOA in the case of this repeater. Let me drop. So the receiver with that rusty nail making and breaking contact will see bursts of noise. You could run this experiment as a way of really seeing it by setting up a repeater where you've got weak signal going into a receiver of a repeater. The output signal is pretty strong, some number of watts. The antenna during the transmitting is, let me pick a number, 5 or 10 feet away from that receiving antenna that's getting the weak signal. And then you literally hold two nails in your hand, hold them near that transmitting antenna, and wipe those two nails against each other. And in many cases, you will hear bursts of static in that receiver. So, slightly erratic contacts near a transmitter create a broadband noise that goes all the way down to the receiver frequency. It's got enough bandwidth to do that. That's one of many things that can cause the phenomenon you're discussing. Over to you for further comments or questions on all of the above, Joe. W-H-U-R-Y-Y, K-2-R-I-W in the TechNet.
Okay, but in a case where you don't actually see the guy up there with the two rusty nails scraping them together and making the descents, you know what's causing the problem. How would you go about attacking a problem like that as far as finding where it's coming from? You've got a massive amount of signals up there on all sorts of different frequencies. Operating a spectrum analyzer would be probably pretty tough to do because of being overloaded so easily. So how would you find the source of that interference?
And by the way, those two rusty nails are making and breaking contact as you wave them past each other. So the amount of signal they pick up when they're making contact, the two nails are a kind of radio short circuit. When they break contact, that short circuit disappears. And so you're getting a local, very drastic amplitude modulation. Only a very minor modulation index, probably a 0.01 modulation index. But at the instant you make and break contact, which takes place in nanoseconds, it's got an extremely brief rise time and therefore a very broad bandwidth to it. To find the source of a rusty nail problem, assuming there's only one source, I mean, in the case of that chain link fence, you wouldn't stand a chance. The whole length of the fence is doing it, all those thousands of places where the wires are winding through each other and making and breaking contact. Let me drop them. But for major, it is one major rusty nail. And if you could have a flexible piece of low PIM coax cable, like Andrew Heliac's, for instance, is a low PIM kind of cable. Braided cable, it's got high PIM. Source of intermodulation distortion. But a low PIM cable connected to a sniffing antenna, and that is the receiving antenna for the repeater. And you now wave that antenna around, and when you hold it near the rusty nail, you will see that the interference you're getting gets stronger. Very difficult test to do. I made it sound very simple the way you described it, with a sniffing antenna connected to the repeater receiver. And the chances of being able to do that are not very good. Another approach would be to choose a windy day when you're getting the interference, and with a long wooden pole, for instance, tap on various things on the tower. And when you tap on the particular rusty nail, you will probably see a change in characteristics. All of these are very low probability of success techniques was done for troubleshooting. This is the most severe kind of troubleshooting I can think of. The actual interference we're talking about is pico or nanopicowatts coming from the rusty nail in the presence of many watts of a transmitter. So the dynamic range of what's causing the problem versus where the source of the energy is coming from makes it a very difficult test. So anytime you've ever looked for that rusty nail, I can probably guess with 99%...
Repeater, timeout.
I can probably guess with 99% probability you didn't find it, Joe. W2RYY, KQRIW in the TechNet.
QGZ.
There's a guy who may have found one once. We'll see. Joe?
Well, I haven't had that happen in a long time, be able to jump on stuff like that. But let's see what QGZ's got to say. Go ahead, Bill.
I bet you Bill has found one once. In fact, I think he described to me a piece of electronics that was buried into the attic as a preamplifier in somebody's house. Over to you, Bill.
Good evening, WB2QGZ. So, yeah, the thing that was in the attic was actually an active interferer, and it was oscillating at, 820 some odd megahertz. But, so, you know, in cellular land, we're operating in most cases greater than 1,000 megahertz. If I have a 2A minus B, you know, at a third order, fifth order, seventh order hit that's strong enough for me to see in my receive system, and in my system at work, I have a 2A minus B right and stuff I'm combining together and stuffing up to the antenna. So, you know, it's kind of challenging to make that work. But for something where you have an actual third order product, you can find it spectrally, right? So I put a channel filter in front of my spec in. I use a pretty well optimized Rode log periodic, and like a metal detector, I can go right to that device, right to the nonlinear junction or the stuff that's causing a problem. Let me drop. And I found, for example, up in a rooftop site where we have a stealthing around us and there was insulation on the floor, I found a whole bunch of tailings from drilling out steel beams, galvanized beams. I found a box of sheetrock screws underneath the insulation just by following the antenna with a decent bandpass filter into the maximum noise, and then I saw a third order product actually being created. Now, news. You know, at VHF, and I'm kind of fighting one of these things right now, is you don't necessarily, there's no PIM tester, and it's really challenging to try, when you're looking for just that broadband noise, to try to figure out where it's coming from. The one or two times I've been successful, I'll say it's been within the first 2-3 wavelengths of the antenna, and I just physically banged on things until I was able to narrow it down. Obviously, distance is your friend with this. So if you can, you can get it right up around the antenna, bang the mounts, bang stuff near the mounts, that's probably where a lot of that stuff lives, usually.
Very fine, Bill. You brought up an extremely important point. For passive intermodulation distortion, you need a significant amount of signal going into the causative device, the rusty nail, so to speak, or the box of bolts for the tailings from drilling out a beam. The metallic sawdust. The thing that's going to be causing the passive intermodulation distortion has to have a pretty strong signal going into it. As such, it's going to be a small number of feet. My guess is most of the time the PIM causer is within 5 or 10 feet of the transmitting antenna. Being near the receiving antenna, believe it or not, wouldn't do it. Being near the transmitting antenna creates the signal. Where there's a real... If you had an extremely high-power microscope in the dark, you might see minor sparks occurring across the rusty nail joints. That's what's really doing it. And so, if you're half a mile away, you wouldn't be creating PIM. But within 10 feet, 5 feet, 3 feet, you can do it. So that narrows down your search most of the time. In the case of Joe's test where he mounted his repeater antenna on top of a rusty, on top of a chain link fence. The fence was inches away, portions of the fence were inches away from his mounting structure. And a whole lot of individual rusty nails were there, so to speak. And in your case also, there are times when you take your large periodic antenna, which has got a known antenna pattern, and you're holding it with a pistol grip-like structure. And as you aim it in various directions, you can see the signal on your display device going up and down in amplitude. I'm pretty sure that's what you were describing earlier.
Repeater, timeout.
I'm pretty sure that's what you were describing earlier. Back to you, Bill. WB2QGZ, K2RIW, the tech net.
Yep, and because of the number of things that people are stuffing into individual antennas, multi-band antennas, one of the issues that AT&T seems to be having with, they have a new carrier on this FirstNet network that they're building, co-located with their sites, is a either a third or a fifth order product at their 700 megahertz LTE band. And what they're finding, and what I'm finding a little bit with some of the stuff we have in 600, is that it's the PIM issues we're having are external. A lot of them are behind the antenna, up in the mounts, in the stainless clamps that hold the stainless friction clamps that pop into like a hole and hold the cables together. So what I think AT&T calls it site hygiene. What we're just doing is replacing a lot of stuff with non-metallic. Where the pieces touch, there we're making them non-metallic. Let me drop. Tushy. And I heard you, Wes. Enritsu and Kaelus, two manufacturers, probably everybody's going to come out with it, actually make a broadband probe that's on the end of a stick. And it's really like a little, like a QFH antenna up on a, inside a little plastic radome, and that works in conjunction with a channel filter and some equipment to, you can use your own signal out of your own site if you happen to have a third order product, or use it in conjunction with a PIM tester that gives you a third order product. And this device, you actually move around like a metal detector and find your PIM causing item. Back to that.
Yeah, using non-metallic mounting hardware strikes me as a pretty crafty technique. And I do remember doing some work on passive intermodulation distortion coming out of an antenna, and some work I was doing about 5 or so years ago. And the rivets that were holding the antenna together, the printed circuit card being held down with the rivets to a metallic structure, and some of those rivets were loose, and you wiggle those, and boy, did that make passive intermodulation so made static in the receiving site. Let's see what Wes has to say. N2XJN, K2RIW, go ahead, Wes.
When you're dealing with broadband interference created by Western AO, and you put the map of spatial X-rays in inverse square signal from the antenna that is up high, and you take the loop antenna and LED, there's LED that is connected on it, on the stick, and you just swipe on it. Now, the signal from this rusty nail would be much stronger when you close, when you have that loop close to that nail, because it's broadband. Let me jump. And it's not resonating at the frequency of the signal from the repeater or transmitter antenna. And that's how you find it. You pinpoint it exactly at the point where it is. And you see.
Yeah, you're making a good point. The rusty nail phenomenon, if you see it on a spectrum analyzer, it's a very broadband mountain of noise. And it doesn't have specific frequencies, but that mountain of noise includes the very sensitive receiving frequency of the repeater system. Therefore, you see bursts of noise through that receiver system, which hurts sensitivity, which hurts range, and in the case of Bill's repeater sites for his cellular telephone system. It affects range, which affects the profit margin, if you know what I mean, the number of customers that can be handled, depending on how much local noise. When I was working with, I guess I was working with Jeff. I was working with Jeff in Oyster Bay, and there was a pole-pig transformer, a part of the power line system, a small number of feet, like 10 feet away from the cell site antennas, and a little bit of hocking and stalking was taking place there, nowhere near enough to give you any trouble, except for a sensitive system, meaning a cell site being very nearby. I'm not quite sure. You may know of the site I'm talking about. I was with Jeff at the time. You probably know about the site I'm talking about. I wonder if they were ever able to improve that noise that particular site was receiving. If you know the one I'm talking about, Bill, WB2QGZ, KQRIW.
Okay, WB2QGZ. Wes, that's actually a pretty cool idea. There's a decent amount of instrumentation available to me, again, above a gigahertz where I'm usually looking for stuff, so I can generally find stuff, but for some of these things where it's just broadband noise and physical filter size and everything else becomes unmanageable, that might be a good way to try to dig into some of this, like this VHF broadband noise thing. That's a cool idea, so thank you. And, Dick, actually, that was another carrier, although I did talk about it a little bit with Jeff. And I don't know if that was resolved. You know, one of the other tools we have in cellular land for finding PIM is, so I have a PIM tester, which gives me two very, very pure tones, and we look for that third order product in the antenna system, and we're looking for, something like a minus 97, minus 100, 103 dBm third order product, something like that. And most of the equipment's made to meet that spec, so that's not too big a deal. Let me drop. One of the things we can do is also derive, like we derive a distance to fault, we can say, hey, is a problem up here or down there, or down here or up there, more appropriately. We can do the same thing with the PIM. So by switching one of the tones and processing it in the test equipment's brain, I can tell where the PIM issue is. And yeah, most of the time it's within 10 feet of my antenna. A lot of times I'll have trouble with like roof edges and flashing on them. And so what I'll do is take a bag of my bag of PIM, which is basically a plastic bag full of steel walls, tape it on the antenna face, get a distance to that location, put a marker there, and then shoot the PIM issue again and distance the PIM. And I'll be able to resolve at that point, is it my antenna or is it in front of my antenna? And at that point, I can start looking around up in front. Now, with no other tools, what I do in the old days is just go over to that flashing and bang it and see if I saw some sort of, similar disturbance in the spectrum display. But, a lot of cool things when there's a lot of folks doing it and spending money on it.
And I have a question in this matter.
Yeah, Bill, you've got one huge advantage with that PIM testing machine. The PIM testing machine puts out a pair of pure high-power sine waves, very pure high-power sine waves. I'll give you a crazy metallic numeric example to show you. Assume you had a 20-watt transmitter on 100 megahertz, and you had a second 20-watt transmitter on 102 megahertz, 2 megs higher in frequency. Any locally generated passive intermodulation distortion will generate at least two additional signals. The two main signals, 20 watts each, very pure, are 2 megs apart, but 2 megs above the highest and 2 megs below the lowest will be extraneous signals, third order intermod. So there'll be a third order intermod at 104, and there'll be a third order intermod at 98. There'll be a fifth order intermod at 106, and 96 and so on. So you've got a very specific frequency to look for the disturbance created by the intermodulation distortion product generating device. Let me drop. Since you know the exact frequency that the PIM is being generated at, you now have the ability with a state-of-the-art spectrum analyzer to go to the extremely narrow filter resolution bandwidth, like 10 or 20 hertz of resolution bandwidth, in which you can get sensitivity numbers like minus 140 if you've got a good preamplifier on that thing. So you can really look very far down for the source. And with directional antennas and whatever, you can do some very fancy direction finding. So these PIM testing, your particular PIM tester, does it put out something like a pair of 10 watts or a pair of 20 watt signals? Over to you for on that one, Bill. Mr. QGZ, KQIW.
LM2EL.
Okay, actually, one of the industry standards is 220 watt tones. Just because we built in 2A minus B right in the network, and it doesn't always manifest itself, we're not always able to come close to the aggregate transmitted power dumped in to the system to try to generate that PIM issue and isolate it. We use 40 watts per tone, and that doesn't really affect the static test where nothing's going on, right? If we see it at 40, we'll see it at 20. It's just some faults are exploited during the dynamic testing when we're actually banging things, like, you know, tapping connectors and hardware and cables. Some things will be exploited at 40 that do not appear at 20.
Oh, amazing. Is that a commercial product, your pair of 40-watt signals, or is it something that you homebrewed, Bill? Go ahead.
Yeah, I wish. No, that's commercially made. The place that Jeff used to work at made that. And I think we convinced one of the other manufacturers of that PIM testing gear they wrote a white paper saying if you don't see it at 20, you'll never see it. And I think we convinced them to change their mind based on our observations. So I think a lot of hardware is coming out at 40 watts now.
That doesn't surprise me. When Jeff and I were doing that kind of testing, we saw that phenomenon. Under normal circumstances, you increase the level of the signals creating the intermodulation distortion, and it follows, if it's third order, it follows a 3-to-1 rule. Increase the power of both signals by 2-to-1, and you'll get something like a 6-to-1 amplitude. Or you increase it by 10 dB, and I think you saw a 30 dB increase in the intermod if you increase both of them. It increased one of them, I think it's 20, but it's a higher ratio. We expected that, but when it comes to passive intermodulation distortion, there's some kind of an additional rule taking place. You want to be able to strike that spark, and it takes watts to do it, and you could be striking a spark at 40 watts, and you might not see it at 20 watts. Okay, we've got Wes and Rich in that order. N2XJN, KQIW, go ahead with your comment or question, Wes.
At this time, it's a question. When you deal with Tesla coil, which is the primary and the secondary, it's like you dealing with a transformer. And even if you have a perfect SWR at primary, because the secondary is asymmetrical, which one part of the secondary is connected to the earth, to the ground, and the other one is up in the air, and it can be compensated with top capacitor, then you're mostly creating a standing wave. What is the way to find out from outside, not by looking at SWR meter, if we're dealing with standing wave using, let's say, spectrum analyzer or any other means?
Wes, you're operating up a brand new subject. Right now we're discussing passive intermodulation distortion. And you switched it over to a standing wave ratio question about a Tesla coil. And I might not have a good answer for it, by the way, but we're going to discuss that a little bit later. Rich and 2EL, go right ahead with your question or comment, Rich.
Okay, Dick, and to be, I want to say on the subject, and I hope I am. When I lived in Whitestone, Queens, I had two incidents of problems with arcing and sparking on HF. One turned out to be my next-door neighbor who plugged in an air conditioner. The air conditioner didn't work, but she forgot to unplug it. The other one turned out to be same thing, arcing and sparking. Not when I found it was a Bell transformer, a guy down the street. You know, I'm going to be moving to Mandeville. I understand there's a guy that works for National Grid. I'd like to have him give me his call letters, name, and I'll hook him up. I don't know where I'm going to find out there. HF, as far as overhead power lines go. Can I change the subject or could you help me?
Now, you're almost on the same subject. Passive things that make interference. And, yeah, we did have the call letters and name and telephone number of, I think it was a Long Island Lighting Company employee at one time that was very good at finding these interference-causing devices. Maybe Bill remembers the guy's name and call letters, but I think he was a local employee. Does that ring any bells, Bill? Can we beat your QGZ, KGYIW?
Yep, actually the guy Mike retired. The two guys I worked with retired there. He's a new guy. I have not had the opportunity to work with him since he came on. I know he solved a couple of problems for another couple hams over in Great South Bay. However, based on his workload and his resources, I think the best thing to do is see if you have a problem first, and then do what you can to try to isolate it, right? And then there's varying levels of what you can do to try to isolate it. But, you know, to call up and say, hey, man, I have noise and go find it is a challenge for him. To say, I located it, you know, near this pole, near this house, near this piece of equipment, whatever. That's generally when you'd like to give that guy a holler. So I'll dig around. Maybe I'll have it for next week. But I'd say don't anticipate a problem. And, you know, if you have something, then, you know, then hit it at that point. WB2QGZ.
Very fine, Bill, and thank you. So, it looks like we'll find him later. It looks like the original guy has retired, Rich. N2EO, KGYIW.
Oh, thank you, Dick. I'm just worried about overhead power lines. Because everything is overhead here. And I hope it's not worse than Mandeville. That's where I got my heart set.
Okay. We'll cross that bridge when we come to it. We're going to go over to Pete now. I think Pete's got a question or a comment. If not, we'll then go over to Hank. But Pete first. KC2KKX, I think it is. K2RIW. Maybe I'm repeating you, Pete. But go right ahead, though, Pete.
KKX. Just wanted to make a comment that was made last week about gamma rays and x-rays.
Go right ahead.
So I think the comment was made last week that you can't tell the difference, just that one comes from an isotope and the other one comes from a machine. And there is some truth to that, but not totally accurate. Gamma rays are produced from isotopes decaying, and when the isotope decays, gamma rays are released, and they're released at specific energies and are mono-energetic, or maybe several different energies, but uniform at each individual energy. Unlike an X-ray machine that has a continuous spectrum of X-rays that are emitted. So if you had a detector, you can tell the difference between a gamma ray and an X-ray. That was my only comment.
Yeah, I think we're talking about quantizing here. X-rays, as you change the magnitude of how high the machine is turned up, it can make stronger and weaker X-rays apparently in a continuous amplitude spectrum. So in the case of gamma rays, I think individual isotopes make very specific amplitudes of gamma rays. Is that approximately it? In other words, by using the right kind of instrumentation, looking at the quantized amplitudes of the gamma rays, you probably can isolate, once you know the distance to your measurement, I think that's a factor, but I'm not sure. Maybe not. Probably we can predict what isotopes are present. Is that approximately what you were saying, Pete? Back to you, Pete.
Yes, this is correct. For example, cobalt-60, that's frequently used in medicine, when it decays to nickel, produces two mono-energetic energies of gamma rays, whereas an X-ray machine or a linear accelerator that produces radiation in medicine, as you stated, produces a spectrum that's continuous of varying energies. Anyway, that was my comment, and wish everyone a good evening. KC2 KKX.
Thank you, Pete. That's good things to know. Wes, go ahead with your comment.
When we talk about a cobalt-60, it's a 33 neutrons and 27 protons. And whenever we talk about gamma rays and X-rays, there is no difference. It's the same electromagnetic wave. It is the difference in the frequency. And both of them could be supported by proper discriminator. There is a number of techniques that have a whole particle lab in my place. Yeah, and I'm playing with it for more than 10 years already. Dr. Roy, please.
Wesley, let me just know that I have it. I'll drop for a sec.
You got it.
Okay, I think we're getting muddied up with semantics. Historically, the difference between X-rays and gamma rays historically was the origin of the source of the photon. Radioactive decay begets gamma rays. Electron excitation produces X-rays. So in the field of generally six, that's a given. So if you look at a spectrum that's accurate for most sciences, you will find that hard X-rays and gamma rays go off into infinity. For astrophysicists, my understanding is they can't tell the difference in the way that that Peter mentioned. So they simply set an arbitrary range below which is X-rays, above which is gamma rays. So in astrophysics, that's absolutely positively correct what Wesley said. There is a strict guideline. Outside of astrophysics, not really.
Good information. Thank you. We know a little more about these crazy waves. And I think cosmic rays hitting the Earth's atmosphere, they generate something like muons. Isn't that true? Give us a few words on that one, Roy. AC2GS, K2LIW.
Yeah, certainly, Dick. Cosmic rays, as we sort of mentioned last week, are kind of misnomers. They're not generically really rays. They're more particles that spray down. They range from high energy, high velocity, free electrons, beta particles, to alpha particles, which are helium nuclei, and protons. You don't get too many neutrons because neutrons have a half-life decaying in 15 minutes, so they decay into something else. So a lot of these things have masses that are rather high, densities that are almost relativistic, and when they collide with, they can act as their own little accelerator And one of the things that they can produce are muons, which are cousins, if you will, of the electron. It's a version of the electron that's higher energy and heavier that we hardly ever see because it's not very stable in our environment. So the muon will decay. That's cosmic rays in a nutshell.
And there is a PBS special where scientists in the last couple of years set up a number of muon detectors in the vicinity of the major pyramid in Egypt. And by looking at the variation in muon flux density, they were able to get a kind of a MRI-like picture, a three-dimensional picture of what's going on inside the pyramid, and they believe they have detected the presence of another room by way of muon detectors. I wonder if you saw that particular PBS special, a NOVA special on the subject, Roy. AC2GS, K2IW, and the TechNet. And by the way, if those are electrons, I'm amazed at those electrons called muons, the specialized electrons.
Repeater, timeout.
The specialized electrons have the ability to penetrate the rock of a pyramid. Over to you, Roy.
I wouldn't quite say they are electrons. They're in the same family of electrons. There's a very weirdness going on with the standard theory of particles in that they seem to come in kind of three sets. There are three sets of quarks. There are three sets of electron-like thing, particles. The one we're used to is the electron, the anti is the positron, but there's also the muon, and there's also the tau particle that's even a heavier version of, say, an electron. But muons are incredibly high-energy particles, so they have a lot more oomph than an electron has. You shoot a beta particle, and for the most part, it'll get absorbed much faster than if you throw something heavier like a muon at it.
That's very true.
Go ahead, Will.
Originally, word X-ray is associated with imaging. But when you look at it from the perspective of gamma rays, you have scintigraphy, which was used with scintillators, which was the technique of finding how much of radiation do you have. But when you forget about it, just forget about it, you think about the gamma and you think about beta. Let me drop. Alpha, beta are particles. Gamma is photon. So there is a technique of doing scintigraphy with photons and with particles, and one of them is SPET, S-P-E-T, which is single photon emission computerized tomography, which is used till today and is a medicine tomographic imaging technique using gamma rays. So actually we're making exactly the same what we have made a century ago or half a century ago with X-rays. There is no difference with it. Only the difference is the frequency, the wavelength. And to
these particles have now been studied, I guess, for approximately a century, I think around the little after 1900 when we started discovering, I guess it was Compton was the guy that discovered the electron, and eventually other people discovered protons and neutrons and so on. We've got two other people waiting, so I'm going to move on for now. We're able to come back to this subject, which we haven't gone anywhere near completely covering, the subatomic high-energy particles. We're going to come back to that next week, or maybe later on tonight. Hank wanted to make a comment, and then we're going to go to Doug in that order. N1YDY, K2RIW. Sorry to keep you waiting this long, Hank. You got it, Hank.
Nothing to be sorry for, Dick. My question is a question rather than a comment. It relates to, is there a simple way to test an electret, microphone component, discrete component, outside of the circuit? In other words, is there a method of powering this thing and testing a microphone that is simple without having to simply resort to replacing components and hoping that the
with small batteries, 1.5 volt.
Yeah, I think almost every electret microphone has something like a half mega ohm resistor feeding its live wire, so to speak, from something like a 1.5 volt battery, and then by capacitively coupling from that live wire and ground of the electret microphone and speaking into it, you will see the audio on an oscilloscope. So I think you almost always put a voltage on it. It's a kind of a variable capacitor microphone, but I'm being overly simplistic when I say that. So a half mega ohm resistor of something like that. If you take a look at the schematic diagram of the microphone circuit of some of our handy talkies, you will see something like the circuit that I just described. Over to you, Hank, N1YDY. Drag your feet in case somebody wants to correct what I just said. You got it, Hank.
Okay.
That's
a good question for this. This is an aviation headset. It's a type that you plug into a general aviation aircraft. Particular headset came to me with active noise reduction in the headset part. That appears to work. But what I can't get to work properly is the actual microphone transmit. And so I'm trying to figure out, since I don't have access to the schematic for this headset, what the appropriate test procedure would be, whether I should just simply start swapping in components to give it a try that way. It's fairly easy to get to the component level of this. It literally pops off of the boom to which it's attached. But I have spent some time trying to research the manic or the pinout for the headset and its internal, pretty unsuccessful with that. So that's why I was asking you that. Why do you ask?
Okay, before we go over to Wes, do you believe the circuit you were trying to get the microphone to work into, do you believe that circuit was supplying the 1.5 volt in something like a half mega ohm resistor? Do you believe that circuit was there, or if it was not there, then the microphone being dead may be a false alarm, if you know what I mean. I'm back to you on that one, Hank.
Well, in standard aviation, general aviation, avionics in the headset, they're delivered between 10 and 14 volts. I'm pretty sure the bias voltage is there because when I tried a different headset, it worked just fine in this aircraft with the same set of radios. When I tried a hand mic in the same aircraft, it worked just fine. So I'm pretty sure I'm dealing with something that applies to the particular headset that I'm fooling with. The headset, because it has this active noise reduction circuit built into the headset, and because it's old, it's already a decade old, when you disassemble the headset, it's not at all simple or clear what how it's wired, which is why I was looking for a schematic first. But if you look at some of the older headsets, they're very simple, and you can see why its voltage comes and what it's. So I have a rough idea of how things work in simpler headsets, but other set of electronics for active noise reduction, I really don't know, and I don't have how the microphone is wired.
Have you ever tried a very high impedance ohm meter, in other words, an ohm meter set to the 10K or 100K full scale across the microphone element? If it was an electret, you're going to see something close to an open circuit. If it was a dynamic microphone, you're going to see something close to a short circuit. And if it was a dynamic microphone, a real coil and a magnet, that's a very different circuit that's intended to go into, very different impedance match and very different level of signal level. So I don't recommend you go to a 1 ohm full scale ohm meter because that can dish out quite a bit of current and potentially maybe damage an electric microphone. But
repeater, timeout.
A microphone, an ohm meter set to the 10K or 100K full scale, I think is a safe thing to test to find out, is that a dynamic microphone? That might be worth a try before we go over to somebody else. Answer that one first, Hank. N1YDY, KQLIW.
Yes, Dick, I have tried it. I used a Fluke auto range meter, and it does appear to be open. There is a a discrete component soldered across the red and black terminals on this microphone that looks like a mica cap, but it's in parallel with the mic, and I'm not really sure what its function is because I don't reference to that when I look up the phone and capacitor circuits for electrodes. I know that it's not a dynamic because the radio or the headset didn't come with a dynamic. The sales brochure describes an electric mic. Quite frankly, this microphone looks like an electric mic. It's cylindrical, has the basic shape of a button-type battery. It looks a little like a dime, something that's a little smaller, a dime in diameter, and perhaps five or six dimes in thickness piled on top of each other to make a cylinder. And it put a meat on appeared to be an open circuit.
And possibly that thing across it is a small capacitor. You know, I'm going to pick a number, 10 picofarad, to adjust its frequency response. That's a guess. Wes, N2XJN, K2RIW, what do you think that microphone of his is? Do you think it's a failed mic, electret type?
You go to Wes. I'm pretty sure that is about a 10 picofarad. I looked up the component numbers that were printed on the on that device, and it appears to be a 9 picofarad based on the numbers that are printed on it.
Very fine, Hank. Go ahead, Wes.
Electret microphone is extremely nice object to discuss. Electret by itself is a wax. Today's time, they do it also from plastic, but it's a wax. It's a dielectric. And it's similar to magnet. That means magnet cannot decay. We could use that word for hundreds of years, and the electric that is representing electret is not decaying for hundreds of years, ladies and gentlemen. It's a permanently embedded static electric dipole moment, and it has high resistance. So think about it as a capacitor. So you have a wax, and now how to test it? Well, you have two legs. So one of the legs you need to connect plus of the battery, but if you have a 2.2 volt, then you use 2.2 kilo ohm of resistor. The second is your ground. And then the leg that is connected to that 2.2 kilo ohm, in parallel to the same point, you connect it with 100 microfarad capacitor, and it will be polarized one plus minus. And then you use the plug, and then you plug it to anything. You can plug it to any amplifier, whatever, the typical plug. And if it works, it works. That's how it works. You're changing the capacitance of the electric. That means you're actually imposing a signal that is variating over 100 microfarad capacitor. And so it's here.
And some of those are very compact microphones. And some of them are reasonably high in performance. Fairly flat in frequency response and pretty high in the voltage output. Doesn't require a huge amount of magnification like you might on a dynamic microphone. Okay, good luck with that, Hank. And Hank, please come back to us and let us know what you find. I guess there's a slim possibility you've got a defective microphone there, and you've probably already confirmed the wiring. There is no open circuit in the wiring or a short circuit in the wrong place. We're going to go over to Doug now, to B2SAY in Rocky Point, Long Island. K2RIW, go right ahead, Doug.
Could I make a comment for Hank?
Yeah, go ahead, Rich.
Okay, Hank. You won't find a replacement electric condenser element. I would recommend Digi-Key because they have no pass minimum. You could buy for a couple of bucks, you could buy an element from them. Are you familiar with Digi-Key?
Yes, I am, Rich. And you know, I don't have any trouble buying the component. I just wanted to make sure I was headed down the right path before I started swapping parts out. That's really why I was asking my question.
Good luck with that search.